Well, last week we looked at kind of an introduction to peacemaking and being a peacemaker. And we essentially overviewed the class and then started jumping into this framework of what it means to live and experience life through the lens of faith, hope, and love. And we looked at faith and just this idea that everything we do is impacted by things that happen to us, good or bad, that shapes our faith in one sense, beliefs, whatever, how you interpret the world, and that carries with you into other circumstances. And so you could project that onto God most foundationally, but that also translates in your relationships with other people. If you've been burned or let down, or maybe your parents were not, they were abusive, or even just not attentive, there's things that you pick up and learn that you take with you in other relationships throughout life. And those can be really hard to overcome, but you can. There can be healing. And part of the essence of the Christian calling is to participate in God's mission, which is making peace. We looked at 2 Corinthians, where God reconciles us in Christ and then gives us a ministry of reconciliation. And Jesus said, if you're a peacemaker, you'll be blessed and will be called a son of God. And so this idea of making peace is inherent to what it means to imitate God at a most foundational level. And so as we look at faith and we can reconcile and grow either through new relationships being built or ultimately reconciliation with God is the foundation for how our faith is restored. That's just one aspect of it. And I wanted to finish out the framework today. I'm not going to take as much time as we did last week, but I just want to finish out hope and love before we jump in, because I think it's a really helpful model for understanding just the dynamics that you might experience in your own heart as you're encountering different relationships, but also to give you compassion for other people, to know that there's a reason why they're doing what they're doing. It might aggravate you to no end, but they're actually acting consistently with the way that they believe in hope and are choosing not to risk in love. And so what is hope? We're going to pick up here on the third page of the last outline. It's primarily tied to the future, right? Faith, as we looked, was primarily tied to the past events. Hope is to the future. It's a remembrance of what's to come, including these dreams and desires, imaginations, longings. And there's a way in which hope ties us in theologically and biblically into this already not yet. Jesus has come, but he's coming again. There's God's kingdom has come, salvation has happened, he's reconciled us, but it's not full yet, right? There's glorification still to come. And so there's hope that all things will be made new. And that's kind of the essence of unique Christian faith. Christian faith gives people a hope that no other religion can. And so I think that's really important to recognize, that as we're seeking to be peacemakers, the whole idea of knowing the end of the story, the hope that we have, is actually really essential for being able to engage once you've been neglected or in a conflict of some kind. And one of the things that will undermine hope is powerlessness, right? If you're in a situation where you can't control it, you can't do anything about it, it will make you and leave you feeling hopeless, right? I can't do anything about it. And you can become cynical. Things will never be different, or you're just going to have this conformist mindset. Well, it'll be easier if I just go with the flow and stop trying. And you just become this people pleaser and you become a chameleon because you don't think things can change. Or you get this unrealistic resolve where if no one else will or can, I'm going to make things different no matter what. And you go on this mission to change things. And really, you may or may not have the power to change it, but you this becomes your whole life's end. What if you're just thinking about the gospel and how what it would mean to have peace with God, how could hope transform or be an important element in making peace or growing in your understanding of handling conflict?
You don't have to be afraid of it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it gives you courage.
Yeah, exactly. It's the thing that can drive you forward. And if you don't have hope, I think it's really important to notice there's nothing to drive you forward. And so faith is very important because it shapes the way we interact and understand based on past experience. But hope is equally as important. And if you don't have hope, you're not gonna have any reason to say, my brother has, we have not talked in 30 years. And if you don't have hope in the gospel, then there's not going to be anything that's going to make you move toward that to think that that could change. But because we know God and who he is, and that all things are going to be made new, and that he is a God of reconciliation, we have hope that things can be different, that God can do something about this. I'm not hopeless.
Yeah, I think quickly, we live in a survivor culture. Culture. And I think in regard to hope, what the gospel allows us to do is to not see ourselves as victims. Even if like heinous sin has been committed against us, there's a sense in which we're victims. But the gospel calls us to be stewards. So even of that, taking a steward mindset rather than a victim mindset. And it's not to minimize sin that happens against us. Sometimes, again, heinous things too. But how do we develop a sense of hope is, am I going to stay in a victim mindset or will I be a steward of this? And how is God calling me to steward this suffering?
Yeah, and I think that's a long journey and process. And I think you're right, but I don't think you'll get there if faith is never dealt with. Right. So I think it's important to see that these things, although they're equally important, faith, hope, and love, there is a building block and progression where you're not going to get to hope if you don't ever resolve faith. Or at least, and that might not be true in every way and in every situation, you might have glimpses of hope, but it could be undermined if faith isn't reconciled. Yeah, that's exactly right. And the longer you experience that, and the more personally and intimately you experience that with God, and then in other people, in relationships, the way that you believe and understand things just continues to grow. Yeah.
Is there a sense in which my brother calls it, sort of like we play the role of the FBI with our children, where we have to always be hostage to the game for them, they're holding on to the hammer. But peacemaking works too. But there's a sense in which I wonder if they have faith and hope if they don't experience conflict. I mean, can't our joy in conflict itself be that this is a moment, this is an opportunity God is using to teach us faith and hope? Because he will resolve this conflict and the next
one. I think that's exactly right. And later in the semester we're gonna look at specifically conflict as an opportunity. And so you're exactly right. As we kind of wrap this up, and for those who came in, there's three handouts in the back. We're wrapping up the one from last week. We're going to jump to a new one, and then there's a laminated sheet that will be a reference later. But love. So we've looked at faith and hope. Love is different than both. Love is not tied to the past or the future. Love is in the present. And it's this purpose, sacrificial giving. There's a mutual enjoying or taking pleasure in one another. A commitment to helping others be what they ought to be. It's empowering and acts for the good of another. And one of the things that is remarkable, even in our faith, right? All of this works together, but the way that God has loved us becomes the way that we then love others. And you see that love isn't necessarily, and even and really in any way, about me getting something out of it. Love is always directed to others. But one of the things that will undermine love, what I mean by that, that will keep you from loving somebody, is uncertainty. So here's what I mean. So what happens when you give your heart to someone that you love and they reject it? You got this conflict, right? Where you love this person, but have a deep wound of rejection. And this ambiguity or this ambivalence, which is the coexistence of opposite attitudes or feelings, such as love and hate or trust and distrust, that can keep you from choosing to love, right? Because what happens is, well, now, the next time I put myself out there, am I going to be accepted or rejected? And one of my professors at RTS, his name is Scott Copeland, he is the one that I got a lot of this from. He has a really helpful just understanding and idea of all the things we've talked about. And I love the way he phrases love. And he says, love, to love is to risk. And I love that because I feel that in so many ways in life where even if it, with Katie or with my children or my parent, whatever circumstance or conflict, it's a risk to acknowledge my fault in it and to, or to even just self-disclose and say, hey, I'm really struggling with this, or I feel this, or when you do this, it makes me feel that way. To actually do that is a risk because you may be squashed. It may blow up and you have all of these thoughts and Satan's there accusing you and telling you, if you do that, this is what's going to happen. And yet, we're called to love. And loving in the present is always a risk. And so, do you have any questions about that? I think that's sufficient for kind of wrapping that up. Before we move on, though, I want to address questions. Do you have any thoughts? Cool. All right. Well, on the next one, so we're starting now formally in Peacemakers, and we're going to break up in groups again, so maybe you can get in your rows or two rows together, however y'all want to do it, but on this sheet, we're going to work through this one at this point, and so I want y'all to get together for a few minutes and describe a time that you wished you had known more about how to resolve a conflict. So let's take a minute, talk about it, and then we'll share it together.
I think it was such a
Yeah, I guess.
But I don't feel that I'm sure.
I also do.
So then now you're doing, plus you're on your own.
About 30 more seconds. Cool. All right. So, if anybody would like to share, what was the time y'all have struggled or desired to know about? Describe a time you wish you had known more about how to resolve a conflict. Let me just read the question as is. Yeah, that's right. What I was about to do.
Yeah,
that's okay. Mm-hmm. That happens. That's a good one. Anybody else?
When you lose contact with a person, but still are holding bitterness and unsettled feelings of to reach out or resolve on your own.
Yeah, that's a good one too, because those things can linger and fester, and that's good. Anyone else? Maybe this side of the room. No worries. He wanted to make you fall, but
how are you going to resolve that? I'm just going to forget about it.
Well, as we, I think one of the things that we can all agree on is there are conflicts, many and in different severities, that we've experienced where most of the time we don't handle them rightly, and it's rare that we handle it appropriately. And even in that, there's a mix, probably. True conflict resolution and peacemaking, unfortunately, often is not the norm. And that's different for all people. But one of the things we're going to do today is kind of look at the foundations of peacemaking. And so this is, we're going to be looking at what's called the slippery slope of conflict. And what we're going to do first is just kind of set the stage of what is some basic ideas or the basic principles, in one sense, that the Bible kind of outlines for conflict. Well, the first is that we could call this the four G's of biblical peacemaking. The first is to glorify God, right? In all conflicts that you have, in everything that you do, it's an opportunity to glorify God. You have the choice to glorify God or to not glorify God. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. And so in all of these circumstances, the conflicts, the harsh word, the lack of listening and sensitivity, or the big things, or maybe somebody steals something from you, or you fill in the blank, there is an opportunity there for you to glorify God. And in fact, you're called to glorify God in it, in however you handle it. And the second thing is that you have to get the log out of your own eye. Matthew 7:5 says, Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount says, "You hypocrite, first take out the log of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." There, so often, I know this is at least true for me, I get mad at my children or my whoever, and they do something that really, in the grand scheme of things, is really small and minor. And I have contributed something that's probably more severe. I have not been even attuned or aware of the ways that I have contributed to it. Or there's other ways where I do the very thing that they do in other circumstances. I had this the other night with Luella where we were trying to calm down in the evening and she just wouldn't listen. Like, it was something super simple. We were just trying to sit down and pray before bed, and like, she was bouncing off couch, and like, it became this game, and I got really frustrated, and I just grabbed her arm and like forcefully just put her down. And afterward, I just realized, like, I got unnecessarily angry at that. And how often, and that's not how my Heavenly Father handles me. And so often I do things far, far worse in choosing to rebel against Him. And that's not His response. And that's true for all of us. And so before we enter in as a peacemaker, we have to genuinely sit and examine our own hearts to see, one, how have I contributed in this? And being willing to listen on how you have contributed, but also, what are ways in other aspects of your life that you're doing the very same kind of thing? The other, third one, is to gently restore. Galatians 6 says, "Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Yet keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted." There's a way of correction that's not helpful. There's a way of engaging conflict that actually produces more conflict. And the key is gentleness. And I think that that is so, in one sense, foreign and challenging, but it's the epitome of who God is, right? When Jesus describes himself, the only place actually he describes his heart, there's a book that came out within the last year called Gentle and Lowly. And his whole idea in this book is based on this passage where Jesus describes his heart. And it's the only place, and he says, I am gentle and lowly in heart. And so gentleness is actually really, really important for preserving relationships. And yet, culturally, in our own hearts, gentleness is often the furthest thing from our experience. And the other is the last. So glorify God, get the log out of your own eye, gently restore, and go and be reconciled. Matthew 5:24 says, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Just a comment on this passage. This is not talking about communion, actually. Some people apply this in communion and say, I'm not going to partake of communion because I have some unresolved conflict. That's actually not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is in the temple, and he's technically here on the Sermon of the Mount, but he's talking about in the context of temple worship. And you bring this offering. It's a peace offering, which is a peace offering between God, but it's also between others. And the idea is, I'm going to come bring this peace offering and act as if everything's good. And Jesus says, no, that's actually not how it works. As in other passages, your relationship with God is connected with your relationships with other people. He says, go and be reconciled, and then come offer the peace offering. And so there's this command that we should be, though, when we experience conflict, go and, as you're able, glorify God, get the log out of your own eye, gently restore, and be the one who is proactively seeking reconciliation. So I'm just curious, of those four, which one do you struggle the most with when facing conflict?
Probably one through four. You know, the thing that struck me is number two, you know, that you hypocrite, take the log out of your own eyes. I mean, there is humor in the Bible. In the sense, I mean, and he's speaking in hyperbole. I mean, it's not humor in the sense that Jesus is making light of this. But the fact that he uses that language, take the log out of your eye, you know, there's a part of me that feels like, okay, I'll do that so that then I can worry about the speck in my brother's eye. But I wonder, maybe you could clarify, I wonder if he isn't just saying, you're never going to get the log out of your eye. So don't worry about the speck in your brother's eye, at least in a way that we like to think about it.
Yeah, I think that it's yes and no. I think that there's a way in which what he's saying is this idea, if you take the image that he's making, the log is bigger than your head, right? So it can't even fit in your eye. So there's a humor in that. And the speck is like a little piece of dust that you can't even see. And so there's a way in which that's true. Yet I've experienced and heard a lot, like growing up, this passage was always talked about as you don't ever have a reason to judge. You don't ever have a reason to, and judge, don't hear that in a bad word, not judgmental, but to make a judgment and go and say, you've offended me. Because Jesus says, take the log out of your own eye. Therefore, don't worry about the speck. It's such a minor thing. I don't think what Jesus is saying is necessarily you can never go and make peace because everybody else's sin is worse than yours. What he is saying is you have a lot of sin that is contributing. And before you can put yourself in an appropriate frame of mind to enter in, you need to acknowledge that.
How can I listen better? And so it's the first conflict of how am I
am I causing this problem in my relationship? I don't know if there is one. Could you tell me? My father is one of the quotes that my mom all the time, my critics are the guardians of my soul, and he lived it. He wanted criticism from us, from he took it from everybody. And it was to help him be better. And I think if we approach conflict as a, how can I now glorify God better? If you can tell me what I'm doing wrong in this.
Yeah.
And I think if we approach it not as, I'm supposed to help fix this, but I feel like, all four of them to me are about the fact that it's supposed to come from the place of, what am I doing wrong here? Instead of, here's what you're doing wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And as we look at some of these other things, what you said reminded me of, just let me, sorry. I hate when that happens. It'll come back in opportune time. I'm sorry. But yes, so thank you for that. As we kind of transition, how would you define conflict? Like, let's narrow it down. What are we even talking about when we say conflict? How would you define it?
I think at basic level, it's just a lack of agreement. It doesn't even have to have anger or anything. Just don't agree on how to do something. It could be that simple.
Yeah.
And you're really angry or frustrated. You could call it that, but it's just, hey, I'm going to do it this way, you want to do it this way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Anything else? You want to add something? Yeah, that's a primary contributor to conflict. Well, here is how we're going to define conflict. And I think both of you have hit it, and there's probably other things you could add to it, but I think this is a pretty succinct definition, and this comes from Peacemakers. But it says, a conflict is a difference in opinion or purpose that frustrates someone's goals or desires. And what I like about that definition is it kind of captures the whole gamut in one sense, where there is this difference of opinion. There's the fundamental basis of conflict is a disagreement of some kind. But it could be maybe someone's intention, the purpose. You intend to do something, but they intended this. You're trying to do the same thing for different reasons, and that can produce conflict. Or you have goals, and somebody else has different goals. Or even desires. And I think I'm glad they added desire, because that's where emotions come. That's where the real pain, the selfishness, you long for these things. You want to feel loved. You want to feel secure, cared for, respected. All of these like really deep things, these desires, that's where conflict really, the rubber hits the road. And so I'm not going to go through you can look through those four basic causes there. What I want to do now is kind of look at the slippery slope of conflict. What is it that they're talking about? So we've kind of outlined what is conflict, some basic like principles for thinking about it. And I have this, if you don't have one of these handouts, you can grab one. They're in the back. It's going to be helpful to kind of follow what we're doing. So there's two things. We're going to start on this colorful side with the circle. This is called a feelings wheel. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of one or been exposed to a feelings wheel, but it's really helpful. It's used primarily in counseling contexts, but I think one of the great benefits of something like this is, one, just helping us grow in our emotional intelligence or just coming to have a better awareness of the things we experience. So let me explain what's going on here. So the very center of the circle, these right here are called secondary emotions, but they're the ones that you experience. So you get angry, or you are disgusted, or you're sad, or you're happy, you're surprised, or you feel bad, or you feel fearful, right? Like, these are all kind of the basic feelings that people could identify, right? Like, when you ask somebody, what are feelings or emotions? Those are probably the things that come to mind. Rarely will you get something different. You might get an anomaly here. And the thing is, think of this like, imagine this, if this was a 3D object, right? It was like a cone. This part would be at the very top, like an iceberg. So, and then you put that in a bucket of water, right? You could see the top. Secondary emotions are the things that you see. But there's a whole lot below the surface that's directing and guiding the things that you see. And so in each of these categories, the color-coded, so you say for anger, well, why are you angry? Well, maybe someone let you down. And in their letting you down, maybe you felt betrayed or you feel resentful and it's manifesting itself in anger. Or if you're feeling disgusted, maybe it's repelled. You feel horrified or hesitant, or maybe you're feeling happy. Right in the middle, you feel accepted. That's because you feel valued or respected. You see, there's something deeper than just the basic feeling of happiness or anger or sadness. And it's essential to identify that in the context of conflict and peacemaking. Because if you never get below the surface, you're actually never resolving the actual conflict, where you have felt inferior, or you have felt, which makes you feel fearful. That's the heart of it. Or maybe you feel isolated on sadness, right? Like you're feeling sad, but it's because you're isolated. Or you're feeling angry, but it's because you've been dismissed. Right? Like, if you never get to those deeper issues, you're never actually going to be able to resolve any conflict. And so, which of these secondary, so the happy, sad, the top of the iceberg, if you will, which of the secondary emotions do you experience the most? Angry? What was you saying?
Bad.
So angry, bad. Any others? Fearful. Well, and I think that for the question, yes, no. I think the point, though, you're right, is we experience all of these in different ways. But there are ways, and we tend to gravitate to some more than others. And as we think through this, let's flip to the backside. Because this is the slippery slope of conflict. So you're presented with this conflict. There's a couple options on the table. And essentially what you're looking at, the blue, these are bad ways to handle conflict. The middle and the tan, these are the peacemaking responses. And so what we're going to do really quickly is I just want to walk through what are these things. And that will kind of set us up to move forward next week. So let's start on the left side. So the escape responses. So this is what we're going to call peace faking. And so a peace faker tends to seek escape when they want to avoid conflict instead of resolving it, especially in the church, where many believe that all conflict is wrong or dangerous. I don't know if that's been your experience, but that's very common in churches where conflict is just avoided and it's escaped because there's this fear about conflict or this negative, like any conflict is just bad. And that's ultimately not a helpful, because what it leads you to do is to fake peace, to say peace when there is no peace. And there's different degrees of this. So starting here and working down, it gets more severe. So denial, right? It's pretending that a conflict doesn't exist. Oh, we're just going to, when you said that, it really didn't bug me, and I'm not going to say anything about it. The flight. You run away by leaving the house or just ending a friendship, quitting a job, filing for divorce, changing churches, right? The conflict happens, and rather than engaging or even just denying it, I'm just going to run. The only and best response is I'm going to get out of here and not deal with it. And you're faking peace because you're not engaging. And it's also not resolving. Sometimes it could be withdrawing, but in threatening circumstances, I do want to say flight may be necessary, right? It's important to just recognize, right? In physical or sexual abuse or other situations similar to that, flight is important, right, for protecting the person. But in general, right, conflict, flight is not a good way to handle it because it's faking peace. And this is ultimately realized in the most severe form in suicide, right? You have to retreat so far that you can't even live anymore. And when people believe they've lost all hope, that they may attempt to take their own lives, it's a really, really sad and depressing and just hopeless situation. And hopefully, in engaging, by having the whole, everything we've talked about, right? Because you don't get to suicide just one day, right? There's been a whole lot of faith, right? A whole lot of past experience that has made you think certainly about the world. You have been undermined in hopelessness and helplessness to where you have no hope that things can change. And you have lost all of your ability to risk and love. And when things get that bad, that becomes the option for escape. On the other side, right, these what we'll call attack responses. So the escape responses, or when conflict happens, you can become an attacker, or what we'll call peace breaking. People use these when they care more about winning a conflict than about preserving a relationship. Often people view a conflict as a chance to control others or to assert themselves or to take advantage of someone. Attacking destroys the relationship. There's different degrees of this as well. So assault doesn't have to just be physical assault, right? Overcoming an opponent by verbal attacks, which could include gossip or slander, right? Physical violence, trying to damage a person financially or professionally, or any sort of, there's this conflict and you're feeling defensive, and to get them off your back, you unload on them for all the things that they've done, or you want to tell them how they're not seeing things rightly. These attack responses ultimately destroy the relationship. Or another degree of that would be litigation, right? Taking someone to court. It's gotten so bad and you're after them that you have to get resolution and you go to court for it. And there are instances, right, when that's appropriate. But just recognize that that is a further degree, and there are ways in which that could be avoided in certain circumstances. And so lawsuits usually damage relationships. I don't know if many lawsuits, right, they go through court and then the opposing parties walk out holding hands, right? And Christians' witnesses particularly can be damaged through that, right? And Paul gives a warning in 1 Corinthians, right, where he says, if at all possible, resolve your conflicts between yourself, right? And he gives this interesting example. He's like, you're going to be judging the world. You can't even resolve conflicts yourself. That's one more degree. But the final degree, right, of peace breaking is murder. You've attacked so hard, and it's gotten so bad, and you need to take it to them, that you kill the one who oppresses you. But Jesus says that we're also guilty of murder when we harbor anger or hatred. And that anger in and of itself, there is righteous anger, right? When you've been sinned against, the righteous response is to feel angry about it. It's okay to feel angry. But anger, when it then propounds because of bitterness or lack of self-control, and that continues to manifest in unhelpful ways, that's when it becomes an attack and the relationship is broken. And so this can be challenging, and I'm just curious. I'm sorry, we don't have time to answer this question. Peacemaking. So the peacemaking response is, a true peacemaker is guided, motivated, and empowered by the gospel. The good news that God has forgiven all our sins and made peace with us through the death and resurrection of his son. And so there's a number of processes here, and we'll get to these throughout the whole semester, but it begins here and then gets more severe. So you overlook an offense, or you seek reconciliation personally, or you bring in somebody to have a negotiation where they're helping you mediate this conflict. Or you go to arbitration where you bring in somebody more formally and they make a decision for you. And then accountability is in the church. We help each other and keep each other accountable there. And I know we're about done. Sorry we ran late. Had to catch up from last week, but now we're all up to par, on pace with where we need to be. Do y'all have any questions about that? I found this to be helpful. Just giving categories, and particularly the big takeaway would be the attack and escape, or peacemaking. And as you think about where you're at, think about which one of those two do you typically run to? Are you an escaper or are you an attacker? And what would it look like to be a peacemaker? So with that, let me pray. Father, we thank you that you are the ultimate peacemaker. And I pray that your grace would be lavished on us, that we would be more like you and could be called your sons and daughters. In Jesus' name, amen. If you can keep these, put them, honestly, if you just stack them up here, I'll come in. Or put them on the black things. What is it called?
Yeah.
It was really fun.